Hey, welcome to Divergent Paths with Dan Dunford, episode number 48. Standing outside in Pleasantville, or Pleasant Town, it's Pleasant something, New York. It's nice out, so if you hear crickets and general outdoorsy noises, that would be why. Hope you're having a good week. Hope you're getting through it. Hope shit's not getting you down too much, although I have to say it's getting me down a little more than a little bit, so I understand if it is. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this episode. Hope that puts you in a better frame of mind. My guest this week is Eric Dudley, who is a wonderful conductor and singer. He will be starting as director of orchestras at San Francisco Conservatory, and he'll be conducting there. He's also a member of the Grammy-winning vocal ensemble Roomful of Teeth, and obviously they're fantastic. And I've worked with Eric for most of the last 3 years, managing two ensembles that he's directed. Of course, he will no longer be directing those ensembles now that he's moving to San Francisco with his wife. But yeah, Eric's a fantastic guy and just really, really great musician. And, he has directed one of the Manus Prep Orchestras for the past couple of years, which I have managed. Occasionally I will have, if they need a trombonist, I'll sit in and play with them. And, even when you play with a high school orchestra, as a professional musician, you kind of expect the level of conducting to, not necessarily be terrible, but just be, kind of simplistic and easy to swallow. But, playing for Eric, even as, with a high school orchestra, is still a learning experience. He's that good at what he does. I really enjoyed this conversation with him. We've been talking about it for a few months, and I was happy to finally sit down with him and cover, his background and how he got into conducting. He was the assistant conductor in the Cincinnati Symphony for a number of years, talking about what he learned there. And, about his singing and what he's looking to do when he goes out to San Francisco. So, this is a really interesting one. He's very, very good at talking about what he does and very good at doing it as well. So, I hope you enjoy my conversation with him. Other news, still working on getting the YouTube channel together. It's taking a little, I've recorded some more, videotaped, Hello 1980, taped some more segments, still working on putting some of those together in a manner that looks good, trying to figure out what works, what doesn't, so that's still coming soon, please subscribe, on iTunes and Stitcher, share the podcast with your friends, share it with your enemies, share it with your family. Write a review on iTunes and Stitcher. That's really helpful for me. So, but other than that, that's pretty much it. And enjoy your week. And, whatever you've got, get through it. Bye. But yes, thank you for sitting down with me. This is cool.
Glad to be here.
What?
Glad to be here.
Yeah. So, being a orchestral conductor is one thing, and that there's a lot that goes into that. Being a choral conductor is one thing. There's a lot that goes into that, and then being a professional singer as well. That's a lot to go into. and there's a lot of study and work that goes into each of these things.
There is.
I have a hard enough time,
practicing in a way that I can play like a big band in a big band one day and an orchestra that night. Is it, you know, do you just not sleep or like what?
I don't sleep much. That's for sure.
But I mean, like, how do you kind of just, and we'll like go back and other things, but just how do you keep the parts separate in your brain to like be able to, or is it just all
I'm not
blend
sure there's
together?
Any rhyme or reason. Yeah, I'm not sure there's any rhyme or reason. I don't know if I am conscious of it anymore, mm-hmm. actually.
Okay.
This has just been something that has evolved as a product of how I make music. And there are days when immediately flip-flopping from one thing to the next becomes a real kind of a challenge. I sort of have to put myself in, okay, now I'm in orchestral brain, mm-hmm. you know, and then I'll walk into a completely different situation, and then, okay, now I'm not in conductor brain anymore because someone else is conducting,
yeah.
you know, and you just have to...
But there's problems over here in this section.
Exactly. And I think early on when
guy.
I... Yeah, early on, I think I was that guy. I was, you know, at least for a time, especially after I moved here to New York from Cincinnati and I had been wearing the assistant conductor hat for so long,
mm-hmm.
and conductor brain was just always on. And then I started singing in some ensembles, you know, to supplement income. And I definitely was that guy for a while of like, well, why is the conductor doing that? What's going on over there? What's, still wanting to, you know, address those things. And it just goes away relatively quickly because you realize, A, you're annoying the hell out of your colleagues. And B, you want to make friends.
Yeah.
And
oh,
C,
okay.
you want to get hired back. So, you know, for all of those things, you just kind of make the decision not to be that guy. But I think it's a funny thing because now, you know, now that I have, you know, hopefully somewhat successfully, you know, established that boundary, people come to me now because they know I'm a conductor and they'll say things like, oh, well, what did you think of what went on there? You know, and I'll just be like, well, you know,
this might be what I may have done.
Someone else's choice.
But, you know, do whatever you want because... Hey,
yeah.
I'm here to sing.
Yeah,
hey.
Exactly. It actually gives you a nice, if you can get into that attitude, you end up developing a kind of a healthy nonchalance about things.
Well, and that way you can like give yourself, just like give your brain a break.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Because if it's always on, then that means you're not like.
Exactly.
That can be, I mean, I would imagine.
And maybe that's how
exhausting.
I do it, actually. I think, you know, more than anything, that's what happens is that when conductor brain has to be on, obviously it's on. But when it doesn't have to be on, it's very much dormant. It's
yeah.
like, all right, whatever. Now I'm just a cog in the wheel, or hopefully not a cog in the wheel, just a spoke in the wheel, you know, and just doing my thing. So,
how did you like get into doing all of this? I'm not like, I don't, you know, I don't really know much about your background, other than like people that I've worked for.
Yeah.
From Eastman
or from
Yale.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think
back in the day.
I think my background has been one of when I first started off as a musician and in my youth, you know, taking lessons on several instruments and singing and trying to write music and all this kind of thing. I think I was always trying to do everything from the start.
Do you have like musicians in your family or was it just like an artistic household or artistic supporting household
for sure. I have musicians kind of randomly strewn throughout my family. My dad is an amateur guitarist. He taught himself guitar from when he was in high school and continued to play all through his life. One of my aunts is a concert pianist, not professional, but a very high level.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, her uncle, I mean, my uncle to whom she's married is a conservatory trained classical guitarist, you know, so there's music in there.
It's around.
Wasn't
like,
yeah.
But you know, sometimes you like, there's people where they tell their family they want to be a musician. They're like, what? Like,
yeah.
How?
Yeah, I never
like,
encountered
how are you supposed
any...
to do that? But if there's like people in your family, they're like, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like even if it doesn't work out, it's not like a useless skill.
Yeah.
Because...
Yeah. There certainly wasn't any opposition to it. There was at times the cautionary, well, you know, you might want to devote enough time to your studies and whatever and other
so you're
skills,
not just like so an idiot yeah.
So you have a chance to make money in some other way if need be. But I can remember actually most of the attitude when I was growing up was, okay, you like this, you're good at it, you should indulge this talent and appetite, but do it with a lot of discipline. It was actually, you know, actually both my parents were pretty keen on saying, if you're going to do this, do it for real. Like, mm-hmm. actually practice and actually, yeah. you know. And they had a very close relationship with a lot of my teachers and wanted to know if I was, you know, progressing according to what the teachers thought was my potential and all mm. that kind of a thing, you know. So, yeah. So they yeah. weren't hands-off about it.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Well, there's also this whole, like, well, if I'm paying for this, you better be doing it.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that's very much a part of it.
I have a student right now. She's 9, playing, you know, trombone player. But mm-hmm. her parents are like, well, I mean, let's just put, their building is right next to Donald Trump's New York residence on East 68th. They've got, like, shitloads of money, right? Mm-hmm. But, like, the music, the kid plays piano, and, like, she wanted to start playing trombone because she saw someone playing it on the High Line. But it's more of a thing where, like, it's not. It's just kind of like, oh, hey, my kid wants to do this, so let's buy them an instrument so they're happy.
Yeah.
But there's no real, like, my mom, like, made me practice. Like,
yeah.
You sit down and yeah. practice. And I love her for it now. I didn't at the time. But this kid, she's just like.
Yeah. Well, it's the difference whatever. Of attitude between is it a toy or is it a pursuit?
You know? Yeah.
And if it's a pursuit, which it is, it should be, then you might as well actually devote some
time. But, I mean, if the kid's 9, the kid's 9. It's not like. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, so.
But anyway, so that, I mean, my background all through high school was very
What instruments
diverse.
Did you play?
I started on piano.
Right.
That was the first. And then when I was in elementary school, I started on tuba to be in the band. That was a bad decision. I instantly recognized that was a bad decision. And then within another year or so, I had sized down to the baritone.
There you go.
And kept on baritone through high school. I studied a little upright bass.
Just
for fun. Because, yeah. I mean, you know how things happen in, like, a public school where it's, you know, you've got a few kids who have some modicum of musical talent, and then the teachers are like, oh, well, can you do this? Because nobody's doing that
right
now.
Yeah, no
one's
like, if you're into it, can you try this? Because no one's doing it, and, like, you have shown it up. An aptitude for picking things up quickly.
Exactly, yeah. And it was literally like when I had gotten to high school and the high school orchestra did not have any bass players, and my choir director at the time, who also knew I was a pianist and studying composition and all this kind of thing, he was like, well, surely you can try bass. I was like, well, you know, I don't know, I guess. And he's like, I mean, these parts aren't that hard. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, so just enough to actually get some commerce with what it meant to play a string instrument. And then that actually helped later on in life when I was studying conducting in grad school and realized that actually it would be quite important to learn more about string instruments. So then I ended up taking secondary violin for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was always involved in many things. I was, you know, I was the music geek at my high school, you know, mm-hmm. one among just a handful. And, you know, played in band, played in jazz ensemble, played in orchestra, sang in choir, wrote music for the choir, did arrangements for the marching band, played in several garage bands, including one like super cheesy like disco revival band.
That's amazing.
With full horn section and female backup singers and all this kind of thing, you know.
So I mean, like, this whole idea of just not sleeping and doing music constantly all the time started pretty early.
Yeah, pretty early on. I mean, and, you know, I was trying to be a good student, too.
Well, and they were like, hey, this dude's doing all this stuff, and we don't have to pay him, so...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
That's what happens.
Yeah.
So that was always my background, but I think that, you know, somewhere midway through high school, I decided to get a little more serious about composition, because I knew that eventually I wanted to go down the conducting route. I had already tried, you know, my hand at some conducting with some of our ensembles in high school.
In high school, well,
yeah.
Like,
and
why?
Actually ended up through that doing actually sort of like kind of professional conducting when I was a junior in high school. One of my voice teachers was the music director for a local like pro-am theater group.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to be away for like half of the shows of a run of the Gershwin mashup Crazy for You that was being done. So he asked if I would be willing to actually learn the score and conduct several shows on that run. And, you know, I was a high school kid. And everybody in the orchestra was adult, and yeah. everybody on stage was adult. You know, so this was putting a lot of trust.
That's a lot of pressure on a 16-year-old, and a lot of trust
that he was placing in me. So I was like, all right, well, yeah, I will do this. I will try to rise to that challenge. And it ended up going really well. And I said, all right, well, maybe I can do this, you know, for real someday.
Because, I don't know, for instrumentalists like that, the desire to become a professional, I mean, for me, it was like when I was 12, 13-ish, just pretty young. I had started a lot earlier. But, like, it makes sense when I play violin, I play trombone, I play whatever. It's kind of a similar for everyone. Like, oh, I'm pretty good at this. I really love it. This is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. But for a conductor, like, where does that come from? It's a little bit of a different. You have to have a specific kind of personality a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you have to be comfortable just being up in front of people,
but
and trying to like, share your ideas in that way.
Did you like see someone on stage and was like, "That's what I want to do," or was it just kind of like a gradual thing?
I had an early influence. At the time, the music director of the Hartford Symphony, you know, I grew up around Hartford, Connecticut. The music director was a guy named Michael Lancaster, and he was great. He was like, you know, kind of like old school British, British trained and British born, and was really interested in education. And he started the program for what they still have to this day at Hartford Symphony, which is the Symphony in the Schools concerts.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And he also started a completely different format of educational concerts. He did the, you know, young people's discovery concerts like most orchestras do, but then he also changed the subscription series of the HSO to include several performances throughout the year for their larger subscription audience that he called Classical Conversations, where they were more like education concerts but for adults.
Yeah.
Where instead of just doing the standard symphonic program where no one talks and you just have Overture Concerto Symphony or some variation of that, they were actually concerts with smaller excerpts and movements of pieces all strung together into a kind of logical connection. And before each piece, he would talk about it. And he would, you know, not in a boring or dry way, but in a actually fully entertaining and engaging way, and talking about why the composer did this with this piece, you know, and how it relates to the next piece on the program and all that kind of a thing. It was very smart.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually helped to grow the subscriber base of the orchestra considerably during his time. And so I was a young guy, you know, just kind of like observing all this, not even really knowing then what I know now, you know.
Yeah.
And now that I look back on it, I can see how much value his music directorship had, even more so.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, I was just like, oh, this is a guy who's an amazing musician, and I want to be like him,
right.
You know. So I went backstage a couple times. You know, my parents helped me to introduce myself, and at one point I had the gonads to actually like bring a piece of mine back and put it in his hand.
Oh wow.
And he said, "Oh, you're into composition." And I said, "Yeah, yeah, here's this, you know, little violin and piano sonata that I wrote that was total crap." again, what you know now, you know.
We can't all be Mozart.
Exactly. But he took this piece of total crap and looked at it very encouragingly and said, "Okay, well, you should study with someone more serious." And he recommended someone at the Hart School for me to take lessons from. And then he said, "You should keep sending me pieces so that I can give you feedback on them."
Hmm.
So I started composition at Hart. I was at the time the only, you know, like younger than undergraduate level student who was studying with a faculty member, and this was all based on the recommendation of this conductor, you know, and then started to get really serious about it, and I kept sending him pieces, and by the end of my time in high school, I had written a piece for the Hartford Symphony to be performed at my high school on the symphony in the school's concerts. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was like this great trajectory of like, you know, he was actually mentoring me and guiding me through the process of you know, actually getting a lot more skill in that area. You know?
It's really, it's interesting. It, you know, a lot of time, you know, especially when you live in New York, it can be hard sometimes to build, like if you're a younger person, there's a lot of people with students, but it can be sometimes harder to build a studio because parents who have really good students as their children, well, they can send them to pre-college divisions of all the conservatories, mm-hmm. and, you know, study with guys in symphonies, guys, whatever. Mm-hmm. But in like smaller cities, it's, you can, like Hartford, like where I grew up in Pensacola or wherever, whatever smaller cities, like it's, students can build relationships with really great musicians a little bit more, because they're more accessible.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you wouldn't have been able to do that with, well, what year would that have been? Like Kurt Mazur. You wouldn't have been able to go backstage and talk to Kurt Mazur, like,
no, or there are several other layers of accessibility involved.
You know, there's so much, but because you're in a smaller mm-hmm. place and mm-hmm. have really, like, it's really cool, like, yeah. music cultures in some of these smaller cities. Anyway.
Yeah. So that was definitely a huge factor, and you know, I still look to him as being my first, like, major conducting mentor, mm-hmm. because he was the first guy who said, like, you know, you can do this, like, you know, you can get better at composition if you want to, and composition is a great track. He actually said that himself, because I think he had studied some composition. He said, if you want to get into conducting eventually, composition would be a great undergrad, you know, because they don't have undergrad conducting degrees except at Curtis, I guess.
Manus.
Like, Manus does. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was unaware of this. Yeah. Interesting.
Well, I think it's basically Manus and Curtis.
Interesting.
That's it.
All right. Yeah. Well, there you go. So I didn't even know about that then, but
I think possibly the only undergrad conducting major that's currently at Manus, though, is a dude who's like in his mid-20s who just, mm-hmm. That's just how it went,
right,
for him.
Right.
It just took him long. Anyway.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, I mean, that was the track I ended up going down, was to study composition at Eastman. But while I was at Eastman, I kept, you know, not getting a lot of sleep and doing a lot of things that, you know, like I also took secondary piano and voice lessons to keep those skills up. I did a lot of accompanying in voice and string studios, you know, organized, like, you know, student orchestras to do various projects.
Yeah. So when you, you know, if you're not, you know, like we just mentioned, there's very few undergrad conducting programs in the country. For whatever reason, I'm not entirely sure. Like, it's hard to get a handle on. I would imagine, like, younger students, like an 18-year-old, they're not going to have musical knowledge to, like, be someone that's worth working with, I guess. I don't know.
Age is a funny question, because they're, you know, you look at the history of some of the greatest conductors, and they developed very early and were in front of professional orchestras sometimes when they were early teens.
How old was Mazel? Like, he was like 12.
He was probably like 13 or 12.
Yeah, like, it's insane. Bernstein was incredibly young.
Yeah.
Mazel was literally a child. Yeah. Like, these guys, you're right. Like, age is not a guarantee.
But now,
age doesn't necessarily mean you're the child. But
the other factor in that is, like, who really knows, like, what kind of conducting Mazel was doing when he was 12?
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm sure he was displaying immense talent, which is why he was given that opportunity. Right. But I doubt he had the kind of probing interpretation of
that he did later, much later in his career.
Yeah. He had later. Yeah. So, like, these things all take cultivation and time. And I think that's the idea about, you know, about having conducting kind of confined to graduate study, is that, you know, if you've cultivated some other skill first, you know, then maybe it's going to translate better.
The reason I bring that up, but, like, how do you kind of keep those skills developing up and developing while you're, you know, in a position, like, where you're majoring in something else, even though this is kind of the direction you want to go in? Like, is composition, like, I mean, is there one thing or another that, like, is better for that? I don't, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think good conductors come from many different backgrounds.
Yeah.
The reason I went the composition route and then continued instrumental studies along with that is because I wanted to, you know, I wanted to take the courses that were required of the composers, which, you know, were orchestration, very important for anyone who wants to be a conductor. Eastman's counterpoint courses, which were awesome. The new music kind of training, you know, I ended up, I think this course is still at Eastman. It's the course that Robert Morris teaches called Current Practices, where you learn about all of the 20th century and contemporary styles of composition, much in the way that a visual artist develops technique, which is through assimilation.
Mm-hmm.
So like, it's the musical equivalent of sitting in a art gallery and copying out the masterworks on canvas, you know, and seeing if you can imitate them from a technical perspective. And so, yeah, it's a course in imitatio. And Bob Morris teaches that super, super well, because it's a combination of like high level 20th century ear training, score analysis and listening, and then composition, where you're actually attempting to create, you know, your own like representations that sound like Feldman, Stockhausen, you know, Berio, Schoenberg, Berg, Webern, you know, it's just like you have to create works that emulate all of those mm-hmm. those, you know, greats in order to kind of inherit the tradition, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the kind of training that I wanted, is right. to have that broadband, you know, musical knowledge that would then translate into, you know, hopefully a sound and a studied approach to conducting.
It's interesting. You know? Every year, like this, of course, this past year, I wasn't a student at Manus, but they were hiring me to play on all their concerts because of lack of students. they always do student compositions. There's always a concert with student compositions on. Now, I'm not saying that these pieces are necessarily like masterworks. They're fine. You know, they're young composers' pieces.
Yeah.
But with like modern more modern language, perhaps, and they have the student conductors conduct them for the concert. And it was like, like I said, we're talking something on the level of Stockhausen necessarily, you know, but conductors struggling with just basic
mm-hmm.
modern
mm-hmm.
techniques, mm-hmm. maybe like consistent use of 5/8. Like, well,
you might want to
learn a little bit about
shouldn't
that.
Shouldn't be that hard.
Like, you know, maybe figure out like how this whole 2/4 to 7/8 to the mixed meter thing works, because you're not always going to be conducting
yeah.
Brahms, Sibelius, and Wagner.
Yeah. Yeah.
At exactly. least if you're in a good musical place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what did you do? Like, you mentioned you put together like different orchestra projects, and like, so how did you kind of keep that going?
Yeah, I mean, this was another thing that I'll just always look back on Eastman as being great for, you know, because like the student attitudes there are, you know, hopefully still the same, that like people are always willing to just like get together and do stuff.
Well, yeah. How much else is there to do in Rochester?
Not a lot.
Yeah.
Not a lot.
Oh, are we going to go to Wegmans
so
again?
That's the thing.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
And the thing is, like, you know, for better or for worse, but at least in this aspect, I think it's better that, you know, there's not a ton of gigs up there, you know, so the students are not, you know, their time is not really being taken up by, you know, oh, well, I'm hiking out to, you know, Penfield to play with the Penfield Symphony tonight, you know, and so I can't do it, you know, because the Penfield Symphony doesn't exist, A, and B, doesn't pay anything because it doesn't exist. So, you know, so it's that, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's that, yeah, like you say, there's not a ton to do in Rochester. And
in that way, you end up with ensembles like Alarm Will Sound, because
exactly.
they put it together with their classmates to new
do
stuff
something
because
more.
They
yeah.
had to do something.
Yeah, because you have the time and you have the passion,
yeah.
you know, so, and you might as well get to know more music.
Mm-hmm.
And the school very much fosters that too. I think the faculty, by and large, you know, they're not the kind of faculty that says, oh, well, no, you should just be in the practice room practicing what I tell you to practice, and, you know, don't waste your physical energy on learning more music than just that. You know, I think it's absolutely the opposite. It's like, oh, no, you have this idea, you have that idea, do it,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I put together chamber orchestras at several times throughout my undergrad there, and they also have very good courses in conducting for undergraduates. Okay. You know, like if you take the higher level courses, it's taught by like Brad Lubman, who's like this amazing new music conductor that, you know, everybody should study with. Mm-hmm. So, and he's great at all other music too. So I felt like I had a very solid undergraduate grounding in that to then go on and study as a grad in conducting. So that was where the real, you know, it's kind of a funny, it's like the whole path kind of narrows down to a path of specificity, mm-hmm. where it's like, I've been doing all these things and
now I'm going to do this
thing. I'm going to do this thing because I'm hoping to put all of those things together into this one pursuit.
Right.
And so that path definitely narrowed and focused for, I guess I could say, about a solid, you know, solid like 7 to 8 years of my life, mm-hmm. you know, which was the 3 years of master's and MMA at Yale. And then the 4 years after that, when I got the gig out in Cincinnati, you know? And so that was like very, very single track years of my
single track my orchestral existence. Conducting.
Yeah.
Yeah. How, so you were the assistant conductor for the Cincinnati mm-hmm. Symphony, right?
Yep.
Now, what, like, who was there at the time? Who was the music time, director?
It was Pavel Jarvi.
Okay, so it was Pavel Jarvi.
And Eric Kunzel was still alive. And he was the Pops.
Pops, right. Yeah, director. Right. Okay. So, as an assistant conductor, like, what for an orchestra, for like a major professional orchestra, what Cincinnati might be like, an American orchestra, Cincinnati is probably like is the upper half of the second tier.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely within top 20, sometimes within top 10.
Absolutely,
think.
Like yeah, really great brass section. Phenomenal as far brass section. So, what does like an assistant conductorship like entail? Like, I mean, is it just like a lot of bitch work?
There is that. There's definitely that.
Like fixing scores for the music director so he doesn't have to, or you know, or like what kind of work does that mean for you? Like,
I mean, basically my favorite line in the contract, which is the line that you should always be suspicious of in any contract, is the very last line that says, "and any other duties as assigned." And that's basically what all assistant conductor positions mean. You know? That's like,
it's like, yeah, there's all this other stuff, but this last line is going to be 90% of what you do.
Exactly. It's like, you're going to do this, 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 and this, and anything else we tell you we need you to do. So that's basically what an assistant conductorship is. And for that reason alone, it actually ends up being really good training, because mm-hmm. you actually have to know how to wear many hats and how to function intelligently in that kind of nonstop environment. But the basic things, you know, I was there for 4 years and my duties varied throughout that time, you know, at basically like different things at different times. I can remember in my first season, it was largely just cover conducting, where you're preparing the scores for every concert alongside all of the you know, scheduled conductors for the season, including mm-hmm. the music director. You know, you're also, because they do live broadcasts and then re-airings of all of their concerts. I was working very closely with the sound engineer all 4 years on doing edits for the broadcasts. So I would sit through, you know, if say it was a double or a triple of a subscription week, I would sit through each performance and make notes
and find out like which parts of which pieces were the best for the re-airs.
Yeah, exactly. Gotcha. And then we would sit in the booth for, you know, 3 or 4 hours on a Monday after the subscription weekend, and we would edit together a rebroadcast, you know, from the best parts and obviously excluding the not so best parts, which in an orchestra like that are very few, but you know, every now and then there's a clam. So
doesn't matter if it's like the best players and the best orchestra. I think it's,
and it's not even that. It's more a question of like, you know, usually all the performances are usable, but it's a question of which were the ones that were the most convincing, mm-hmm. you know, or which was the one that the soloist of the weekend felt the best about or something, you know. So you cut those together to create something that is a great, you know, really something that could be released as a commercial recording. Mm-hmm. And And now there are some orchestras that are actually doing that.
Yeah.
Like Seattle Symphony, I know, is one that they're not doing, you know, studio recordings anymore. They're just using their concert broadcasts.
The ones that
go especially well, they just edit them together and create a CD.
Well, I mean,
yeah,
you don't have to pay the musicians more if you do that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, definitely economizes on a lot of fronts, but it also gives you that exciting thing that we sometimes lack in studio recordings,
which is the
performance aspect.
Yeah.
You know?
And and you kind of, you take it a little bit out of the hands of like a studio engineer, like, because obviously with an orchestra, you have people who are in charge of that from the orchestra to make sure. But at the same time, like when you're in a studio, like there could be heads butting over, oh, well, we're going to use this, we're going to cut it together. Oh, hey, it doesn't line up perfectly, but whatever. Oh, yeah. Like,
I've been in enough studio recording sessions when I was in Cincinnati to see the whole train come off the rails, you know, which it can do, you know, it doesn't happen often, but, you know, I remember one very specific recording of Chike 6 and the opening viola solo of the first movement, or soli, I should say, that, you know, just did not go well at all. And it was the sum total of certain tensions that had been building within the section and between them and the conductor, and, you know, that all just kind of like led to the recording session, and there was a lot of angst about that particular passage already. Mm-hmm. And over the course of trying to record it, the passage just degraded to the point where it just lost all musical cohesion and sense and all this kind of a thing. And it was like, well, if we had just used the in-concert version of any of those three performances from 2 weeks ago, it would have been absolutely fine.
Because, I mean, in that situation, people, I mean, professionals, even if they're not in a great place, they'll get up for a concert and even at least, or get up enough for a concert to where it's not.
Yeah. Well, and also in the concert setting, you can't stop. Yeah.
Which is great.
You don't have that ability. You don't have that element of being able to stop and say, well, no, that wasn't perfect, let's fix that. Or no, that now wasn't perfect, so let's fix that. Oh, no. And so then it becomes something that you're never supposed to have in a recording session. But every now and then.
The longer you go, the more drunk the trombone section is.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, that was a major part of the job, actually, was being present to just facilitate all of those things.
But I mean, are you in a position where you can really learn from the music director and the conductors who come in?
You're not because
sometimes it can seem like an assistant conductorship all means more of just like a personal assistant for
I think you have to be proactive about it, you know, in a position like that. You know I was lucky to have developed a great working relationship with Maestro Jarvi, and you know, and he was also already the kind of conductor that was willing and wanting to help his assistants, you know, to actually engage with them and teach them something, hopefully, you know. So I was lucky in that respect. But you have to ask for it, you know. Like, if you're in a position like that, you can easily just fold back and just be like, he's the guy sitting out in the house covering, you know, and not really talking to anyone.
Yeah.
You know, or you can be the guy who's like doing that and talking to everyone and trying to get advice and trying to be like, oh, well, how would you conduct this passage? And what, you know, and oh, I see you're doing this there, and why, you know, that kind of a thing. And so you're actually learning about things and asking, you know, asking questions. And then, you know, also during that time, you know, I conducted the youth orchestra that was a part of the Cincinnati Symphony, the CSYO for all of those 4 years. So that gives you actual on the podium experience with, you know, younger but highly developed players. And then I would be assigned to concerts basically based on the orchestra's needs and based on my own progress. You know, so like in the first season I was there, I think I may have conducted maybe 2 or 3 performances with the actual orchestra, you know. By the time I was done in my fourth year, I was conducting like 40 performances with the actual orchestra, you know, because it was just like that was what the needs of the organization were, you know, all of the education concerts, family concerts, community outreach, you know, right. several special concerts throughout the year, one subscription concert in the season, one subscription in the summer, you know, so all of those things stacked together to where, you know, hopefully by the end of the trajectory of a job like that, you're actually doing quite a lot of conducting with the big guys, you know, and that gives you the experience you need to then go out there and...
Yeah, and at that point, like, well, I mean, and... I mean, it's one thing, it's funny, like, in... as a younger conductor in New York, it's weird, because here, like, you might get some work with here an orchestra here or there,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of times, like, you what more often you see is people putting together their own orchestras
yeah.
to
yeah.
put together and finding donors and trying
New York is
to,
just a harder trying market. To
co- well, I mean, the good places are, like, they're booked up.
Yeah.
You know, but on the other hand, like, something like that's not going to look as good on your resume, even if you created it yourself, mm-hmm. to go out and for another, you know, for another job. But
mm-hmm.
what are you going to do? Move somewhere else, huh? No. Apparently. No. so when you, well, before we, like, move, you said you're, like, conducting the Youth Symphony as well. And by the end of your time there, you're conducting the Youth Symphony and you're conducting, like, all of these concerts for.
Mm-hmm.
What was, I mean, you're conducting, like, high-level kids. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, obviously, you came here. You know, you've been in New York working with Manus Pratt for the past few years. But, like, how is your approach, you know, what even when you're dealing with much very high-level younger musicians, mm-hmm. like, how is the approach different from the, you know, high schoolers to the adults? Like, obviously, you know, they're a little bit less developed musically, but mm-hmm. you're still wanting a great performance no matter who you're conducting.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a hard balance to strike, I think, but I think what I evolved into by the end of my time there, and hopefully I'm doing still, is I basically don't do anything differently myself.
Mm-hmm.
I aim to conduct an orchestra of any level, but especially, like, if you're talking about, like, high level younger players versus professional players, I aim to do the same thing in terms of how I'm conducting, you know? And the idea is that even the younger orchestra, which might have the tendency to rush or, you know, play
or do whatever.
With less than perfect
yeah.
ensemble or, you know, or, like, do something completely unpredictable in the middle of a solo passage or whatever, you know, like, these things all happen, but the basic framework of my leadership is the same. I'm trying to through my conducting, bring out the best potential in the room, you know, encourage strong and convicted shape, phrase shape and you know, goal points in the music, and also go for, you know, the same kind of aspirations of, you know, alignment, you know, and chamber musicianship that you would have in a professional orchestra. So, you know, I think where some people who do a lot of conducting of younger orchestras kind of make a little bit of a mistake is that they evolve into a style of conducting that's based on just trying to keep the train together, you know, and then it becomes very beat heavy conducting, very like, okay guys, this is the rhythm, this is the beat, and you've got to follow it, you know, rather than trying to build the ensemble's reliance on their collective sense of pulse, you know, which is actually what's required for great orchestral playing.
Right.
You have to have an orchestra that has a collective sense
of
pulse.
Well, that's a, it's in, you know, it's funny that you're, like, speaking about it this way, because, I mean, obviously, I've kind of, you know, I've managed the orchestra, the Manus Prep orchestra that you've run the past few years, but, you know, of course, that always means bringing, because of the school's needs, means bringing in
uh-huh.
young freelance professionals uh-huh. from the people that I know.
Absolutely.
But in talking to them, like, when you know, and I've played, obviously, as well, but in talking to them, you know, pretty much, like, it's in agreement with these people, with the people that I've brought in, it's even these professional musicians are getting a lot out of your conducting as much as the students are. It's like an approach that works across multiple levels, because it's not, I don't know, kids are, the younger people are able to, we don't give them enough credit sometimes. Right. Like, really good young musicians,
right,
like, are capable of far more than they're given credit for.
No, they absolutely
especially
are.
In the music.
And like, I think if you try to conduct them as professionals, and then whenever they're not quite responding to that, you just simply tell them.
Yeah.
Then that's a lot more effective than, you know, trying to conduct in a different way,
mm-hmm,
that kind of, you know, I hate to use this term, but kind of like dumbs things down to where, like, you know, all right, well, if you're not keeping the beat well in that section, then I'll just give it to you really strongly so that you can't possibly, you know, yeah, do anything else. You know, like,
it's like, no, you come to me. I'm going to stay here. You come,
I'm
going to
do what
me.
I do. And like, if a passage is rushing, then you just stop and you say, you guys are rushing, you know, and just correct the problem. But don't change the style of conducting,
right,
you know, just actually conduct in the way that the music itself requires, and then address any issues that arise through rehearsal, mm-hmm, you know? And I feel like through that, you end up coming much higher, you know, in the end result than you would by, you know, by trying to conduct down to the level of the minute, you know, and the boring,
yeah,
I mean, rather than, you know, going for the overall shape and larger, more exciting picture.
And there's, you know, there's a lot of conductors who do that with professionals, whether it's for lack of rehearsal time or whatever it is. And it's that whole, like, let's just, what you, like what you said, keep the train together,
yeah,
so you don't crash in the middle of a performance. And yeah, sometimes that happens anyway.
Yeah.
But there's not a whole lot of, like, pushing beyond just getting the notes out.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when you left Cincinnati, did you come here?
I came here pretty directly.
Directly from Cincinnati.
Yeah, yeah, because what ended up happening was I was doing a bunch of guest conducting by then and was up for a few different possible positions. But a good buddy of mine who was a professional clarinetist and rapidly turning conductor here in New York, we were both trying out for the same post. We were the two finalists. He ended up getting it. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't have been more thrilled for him, actually, because it was his entry into professional conducting. And he basically, we sort of pulled a swap. Mm-hmm. We were like, oh, well, I would really like to move to New York. And he was like, all right, well, you should take over my assistantships in New York and, mm-hmm, you know, and just move there. And I was like, okay, great. So it just kind of all worked out because I had some guest conducting built up here already. Or close enough that I would, you know, by living in New York, I would be accessible to things. And, you know, it just seemed a logical step. The thing that I didn't count on, or maybe I did, but didn't even fully realize it until I got here and this thing started playing out, was that I had such an extensive community of friends and fellow musicians here in New York, people that I hadn't seen in, oh, there goes the water.
Yeah. Sorry. All right. You had such a
community, yeah, such a community, right, of musicians and just friends here in New York that were from earlier on in my life. You know, people I hadn't seen since Eastman and Yale days or whatever,
right,
but all through their individual paths, they had ended up coming here to New York and you know, putting down roots and setting themselves up professionally. So almost instantaneously when I got here, it was like, oh, Eric's here, you know, we should get him involved in this, we should get him involved in that, and I was, you know, and I was like, well, okay, why not, because I'm new to town and I got bills to pay, you
yeah,
know, so it was like,
yeah,
you know, and I had my conducting activity and I was, you know, actively seeking more anyway, but it was like, all right, well, I can keep doing that and I can explore some of these other things as well. And one of the first things that came up was my roommate at the time, who's a member of So Percussion, was at a, you know, just at a concert, like a post-concert, like, reception, and just randomly was talking to the guy who happened to contract for the Trinity Wall Street Choir. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, well, we're looking to fill a tenor spot. And Adam was like, oh, well, my roommate Eric just, you know, he just got to town, and he's a tenor and conductor, but I know he's a tenor because he sang at Yale and before that, you know, and whatever. And so I was like, I'll tell him to audition. I said, why the heck not? You know, Trinity Choir, great ensemble, great reputation. Seems like it could be a good gig.
Regular money.
Regular money, you know. So I showed up for the audition and ended up getting the job. Mm-hmm. And was like, all right, well, I guess I'm now a professional singer again, in addition to being a conductor. And it was actually out of that Room Full of Teeth kind of ended up being a development, because at the time, the composer Caleb Berhans was in the Trinity Choir, and he happened to be very close with Brad Wells, the gentleman who founded Room Full of Teeth. And at the time that Brad was looking to form the ensemble, and he was, you know, kind of soliciting names for possible singers, Caleb put a whole bunch of singers' names forward, including mine, you know, people that he had worked with in the New York new music scene, in the Trinity Choir, all that kind of thing. So that's what ended up, you know, getting my name in the loop for auditions for that, you know.
And I mean, it's funny that, well, obviously, like, people who are listening to this probably are familiar with Room Full of Teeth, the Grammy Award winning vocal group. but you mentioned earlier, just like, you like specifically, like, you mentioned, like, what basically one class of your time at Eastman, mm-hmm. one really, and it had to do with studying techniques of all of these 20th century techniques and practices of all of these 20th century composers, and the experimental type things that go into that. And, you know, what does Room Full of Teeth do? It does experimental vocal techniques. Exactly. And, like, you know, pushing the boundaries of what's possible with human voice as an ensemble. And, like, and it's actually a thing that people like to listen to, strangely enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
You know, and of course, you've had a lot of opportunities that have come with that, whether that's touring, whether that's singing with very famous people.
You mean backup vocals for Kanye?
I mean, you know, whatever. but, like, that's
fun.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Singing the entirety of 808s and Heartbeat at Hollywood Bowl, that's
pretty cool.
The coolest thing ever. I love that album. But
and actually putting a little bit of, like, Room Full of Teethiness into it, you know, which that was the most exciting part about that. Well, was like, you know, he just heard what we were doing and he was like, ah, I love it. You guys just do that. Just do whatever, you know? Whatever moves you. Yeah. Like, okay, great. We'll put in some throat singing and make some strange sounds, and becomes part of his lexicon.
Yeah, you know? I mean, like, that's good for any musical group.
Totally.
Well, you know, and you never thought that, like, that part of your life would come back to be a moneymaker for you in the future? I mean,
no. But so it's been this really interesting, like, you know, like we were saying earlier on, it's like, how do you end up doing all of those things, you know, and like having it make sense? And so I guess what I'm saying is, like, you know, I came from a background of having done that already as a younger musician and in my training days and all that kind of a thing. And then the, you know, the hourglass shape of my career narrowed to the middle, where it was like, ah, those are the conducting alone years, you know, years of specificity, years of, like, you know, basically doing what you have to do as a conductor, which is devoting significant time.
Yeah, and that's when you put that. That's when you put your 10,000 hours in.
Exactly. You know, and then since then the hourglass has expanded back out, mm-hmm. to, like, okay, that stream has continued, and we've added in a whole bunch of these other things that were part of my musical past. That living in a place like New York seems to invite, mm-hmm. you know, it actually seems to invite that kind of diversity of activity.
Now, you know? So obviously, like, the styles of, like, more choral vocal type of music is, like, the way you approach that, like, in your brain, the way it, like, is built ensemble wise very different than how, like, orchestras function and how they approach, you know, phrasing or musicality. It's different. But you're kind of in a position where you kind of go back and forth between those two worlds. We kind of touched on it up at the top of the interview, but, like how do the ways you approach one or the other, like, go back and forth? Obviously, like, it's all music. I mean, there's things, of course, there's going to be things that overlap, but are there, like, maybe things that are not quite as common in one area that you like superimpose onto the other.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I feel like now that I've re-immersed myself in vocal music in addition to orchestral music, it's actually changed me a little bit as a conductor. Because I've started thinking about, whereas before I used to think about orchestral scores in very kind of like, very kind of like specific terms of, oh, well, you know, this instrument is doing this, so they need that, and that instrument is doing that, and they need this, and all the, you know, it's like thinking about the specifics of execution and the orchestrational implications of things, and like approaching it from a very analytical standpoint. I've moved to a point where I do that still, but I also now tend to think about orchestral music in vocal polyphonic terms. I'm thinking about instrumental lines as vocal lines. And when I'm looking at a score now, I try to think of, you know, how is the composer, you know, trying to structure the orchestration here to create a sense of vocal polyphonic texture, you mm-hmm. know? And you don't always get that in orchestral music. There's a lot of orchestral music that actually intentionally eschews that mm-hmm. and makes it much more right. about timbre, color, articulation, you know, things that voices aren't so good at doing, mm-hmm. you know, or they do them, but it's not the thrust of what vocal music is, right. you know? But it has definitely helped, especially with the standard repertory, to look back on Brahms scores and, you know, Mendelssohn scores and whatnot, and be thinking about, you know, the sort of the basic fact that in the end, most orchestral players, when they're studying their instrument, a major part of developing sound is trying to make it vocal mm-hmm. and trying to bring across the sense of singing through the instrument.
Right. I mean, like, you know, on like just from my specific instrumental point of view, I mean, especially with a lot of the older guys who mm-hmm. came up, I mean, not there's like the old guys, and then there's like a middle generation, and then mm-hmm. there's the new guys. The middle generation like grew up on these like Italian opera singers, and like, you know, there was a very specific school of trombone playing that was like all about singing through the instrument, and that, you know, some of the newer guys don't approach it that way, but there was like a, like the guys who are now the titans of the industry, like yeah. it's all about the singing trombone. There's actually a book called The Singing Trombone, right. you know, and all this kind of vocally based tone production, you know, yeah. and thinking of phrasing it like a vocal singer as opposed to just like breathing whenever you feel like it.
Right. And I think that is just part of the shared history of a lot of these instruments that have ended up in the orchestra and voices. Yeah, the fact that, you know, trombones come from sackbuts, which were used regularly to double voices in Renaissance instrumental and vocal texture.
Trombones were, you know, doubling voices all the way up until Mozart. Like yeah. in, you know, it was for a long time, trombones weren't even allowed to be played outside of the church. Yeah. Like they hung them on the walls and were like, this is it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but that, I mean, that's,
this is where these instruments live. Yeah, exactly. So like,
what happened,
you know, and many of the modern wind instruments follow a similar lineage, yeah. you know, I mean, the clarinet is kind of obliquely descended from the cornetto, you know, which was another vocal doubling instrument. And so is the trumpet, also kind of equally obliquely descended from the same instrument, you know. Yeah. So it's sort of like you get these paths that have been set up way earlier on in the history of instrument building that translate down to, you know, the modern orchestra is basically mostly filled with instruments that were like at some point involved in vocal music, mm-hmm. you know. So I tend to think much more along those terms now. It's just that there are still crucial differences.
Yeah, of course.
Which is that, you know, like there are certain aspects of conducting vocabulary that you need to have in order to be an effective orchestral conductor. And some of those things have little or no place in choral conducting.
Yeah.
You know, like singers really don't need to see a lot of click or a lot of strongly, you know, strong ictus kind of style of conducting, because that's actually counterintuitive to how the voice is making sound. And if the voice is making sound that way, it's going to be unhealthy, you know?
It'll sound weird too.
Yeah, exactly. So like, whereas, you know, instrumentalists look for a clear point of attack, you know? So especially in rhythmically active music, your conducting style has to at least reflect that somewhat. You know, you can round things out depending on what you want sonically, but still, I mean, you know.
Or you can be like specific conductors and just not give a shit about what your musicians want and still be hailed as a great musician.
Right.
You know.
And there's all kinds of that all throughout the whole, you know, field.
But yeah, no, like as a musician, as a person who mostly only plays for conductors, yeah, it's great when I know where
where the actual beat is.
Even if it's not particularly rhythmic, even if it's just whole notes, it's nice to know when to end the whole note.
And I think that's part of the game with orchestral conducting is knowing, you know, developing a sense as a conductor for when you need to do that and when you can not do that. You know, like there's a whole like subtle range of physical awareness as a conductor that says, like, this is something that will be helpful to the musicians at this moment, you know? And then here's a moment where they don't really need so much help, and I can do something that shows a larger shape or a different kind of gesture that might, you know, help the music in other ways, you know? So it's constantly, you know, kind of establishing that, you know, differentiation between, like, you know, because in the end, the whole goal, at least how I've been taught conducting and how I intend to teach conducting, is, you know, you are trying to be as helpful and as communicative with the musicians at all times as possible.
Yeah.
You know, that's the goal. You're communicating something with and for the musicians, you know, and trying to craft an interpretation that's based on constant, you know, involvement and contact on your part that is in some way instructive or helpful, you know? And not all conductors achieve that at all times. It's really the rare geniuses who can, you know, and it's to that we aspire. But in that sense, I do believe that there are some major differences between fulfilling that role in front of an orchestra and fulfilling it in front of an ensemble of singers.
Yeah.
You know, there's just, it's just different.
It's just different
ways of doing things, you know? And then when you have the two together, like the production I just did at Ojai, it was seven singers and seven instrumentalists. And you have to continuously, you know, skirt those boundaries,
yeah,
you know, because it's like you want to create a physical setup that is conducive to good singing at all times, but there are other times when you need to create the kind of beat that the instrumentalists need to play everything incisively, and that means that you're showing the singers things that are a little more incisive than maybe they need to see, but it actually does help them in that sense, you know.
Like, yeah, it's, you have to straddle that line, because even though seven singers, seven instrumentalists are separate, it's still part of the same larger ensemble. You're creating like a group. I don't know what the pieces you were doing were, like what kind of pieces were, but you know, you're ultimately it's just one sound that happens to be two disparate things that have to be approached differently.
Yeah.
You have to.
And I mean, the thing is, smart singers know this, and they also respond to a lot different kinds of gestures than just your standard, like, oh, here's your round, you know, singing choral setup that's gonna enable you to produce vowels well and prettily, you know. Like, with high level singers, they're gonna do that anyway.
Yeah,
you know,
they don't need you to show them what they're
yeah,
what,
and actually
what they
at
know
times
do
they do need that kind of incisiveness. I mean, especially with a lot of the very, you know, like contemporary oriented, you know, very new music singing groups that I've done, you know, been a part of here in New York, that, you know, whether I'm conducting or whether someone else is conducting, you know, the music itself is so complicated that you actually need that incisiveness. You need that orchestral approach to show, like, oh, well, yeah, that's how we navigate this, you know, 5/16 to 7/8 to, you know, 5/4 to 7/16 to 1/4 to 3/8. You know? Like, that's not the kind of stuff you get in most vocal music.
But and you have to have it. You have to see it.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
in
it's
that
just
sense,
gonna...
it has to be what it is. It has to be incisive. And also, singers who are singing at that level know how to use their voices in ways that give a rhythmic degree of incisiveness that otherwise wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. You know, it's putting consonants in places that create rhythm, and it's, you know, it's opening to vowels on specific parts of the beat, parts of the subdivision that actually create the rhythm for that line, you know? So it's, and sometimes these things aren't even just articulated. They're just felt subconsciously because, you know, you've got a bunch of smart musicians in the room.
Yeah.
But.
So I've always, one thing, you know, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but just like, and I, every time I'm playing with a conductor who like, I play with a lot. I've played with a lot of conductors who barely know what they're doing. But when you're playing with someone who knows the specificities of how to work with a string section and work with a woodwind section, has the knowledge, like the knowledge of each section, like a good conductor should. Mm-hmm. There's just so much there. We'll handle this bowing like that. Like string, you know, cellists handle this bowing like this. Clarinets, I'd prefer like this kind of articulation. Can you do it like this? Mm-hmm. What are those kind of challenges like in balancing all of that, being able to give the specificity when it's needed, but not like bogging down a rehearsal in being overly specific. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. you might hear a missed note in the horn, but one pet peeve of mine is like when a conductor will stop an orchestra and
every
be like,
time.
You yeah. missed that note. It's like, I got it every other time. It's just a crack notes happen sometimes, yeah. dude. It just drives me insane. Yeah. But like being able to deal in those specificities while still like being able to efficiently rehearse an orchestra yeah. as a whole.
Yeah. That is where the concept of knowing how to pick your battles really comes in. I really believe that, because then it's, yes, you need to know those specificities, but the higher and higher level orchestra that you're working with, the more those specificities take care of themselves mm-hmm. because of the personal management of each of the players, and also because of the sectional management of the principals, you know? So a lot of those specifics are already figured out. So I think in that context, and because rehearsal time is so limited, as a conductor, you really have to know, like, if you want something to be different from a bowing standpoint or from an articulation standpoint or something like that, you have to have a very clear picture of why you want it to be that, and also a clear picture of how to say it in a way that it can be, you know, understood almost immediately, and then executed in a way that applies kind of across the board, you know, rather than too specifically, you know, because, you know, I've seen like in something like Bach cantatas, for example, because I've been, you know, through my work at Trinity involved in performing over the last 5 years, the entire known cycle of Bach cantatas, you know.
Well, there's only like 12 of them, right?
Yeah. Not so many, but, you know, so like, obviously, especially with Bach string parts, there can be a lot of discrepancies in terms of how they are approached from a bowing standpoint. Of course, a lot of those are determined by whether you're playing on historical instruments like we did at Trinity, or whether you're playing on modern, you know. But in either case, there are potential quagmires, you know. And it's not just bowing, it's also like decisions about like rhythm and articulation and notation, you know, because like the typical problem of Baroque music where you have, you know, two kinds of notation where there's eighth note triplets and then there's a dotted eighth sixteenth,
right.
That the whole question of vertical alignment comes up, and it's like, so this is a notational convention, yes, but each situation is different,
right.
And in each situation do you make the decision, well, clearly the composer had both of these kinds of notations, and if they wanted to use triplet notation, they could have in this instance, but clearly they didn't. So it becomes an interpretive issue that as a conductor, when you pick that battle, when you decide to go down that road, you better have very clear ideas about how it is going to work.
Because otherwise it'll just devolve into like
instantaneously
a mess.
Instantaneously will devolve into every musician in the room asking, well, what about this measure, what about that measure, what about this passage, you know. So you have to be able to articulate those things very precisely and very, you know, like applicable across the board, like to just like, if you've picked that battle, you have to have it well planned.
Yeah, it's just, you know, preparation.
Yeah, it's just you have knowing to have your and, battle strategy.
And just knowing, like, just knowing the music more than I mean.
Yeah, and then the other thing is knowing, like, you know, yes, as a conductor, you want to strive for having commerce with all the different sections of the orchestra, with the needs of different instruments and how they're played.
The needs of different personalities.
Yeah, exactly. But you also have to know that you don't know everything. Mm-hmm. And you have to know how to defer to, you know, to the principals or you know, to the people that are your colleagues, you know, to say, well, this is the musical result that I want. What's the fastest way we can achieve that? You know, without even addressing the, like, say there's a passage in the violins that you think there could be a better bowing, you know, but you're not quite sure what that bowing is, because admittedly, I'm not a string player like the concertmaster of a great orchestra is, you know? So what you say is, I'd like this phrase to be shaped differently. I think we should lead it to here. You know, it sounds like we need a little more bow earlier on, but I'm not sure. Can you give a solution?
Yeah.
You know? And then the concertmaster just goes, done. New bowing. Is it to your liking? The whole section tries it out. Sounds great. Good. Keep it.
And we're done.
You know, and we're done. And we haven't wasted rehearsal time with the conductor trying to prove himself by saying, oh, well, I think if we do down bow here and up bow there and blah, 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 you know, and then the musicians all kind of, you know, giggle a little bit and they try it and it doesn't work. And it's like, see, you're not a violinist, you know? So you just have to kind of know your limitations and pick your battles intelligently, you know? And that's half the game in figuring out how to be effective as a conductor, you know?
Picking your battles intelligently. Yeah.
And the whole thing about stopping for notes, absolutely not.
That's the biggest thing.
You know?
Something
it's
like, you run into.
You have to recognize it. You have to identify it. But that can be as simple as just a shared glance with the player.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, something happened. Your visual attention goes there for a second. The player gives you a little, you know, eyebrow raise or something, and it's done. Nothing needs to be said about it. Nothing, you know, it's just an acknowledgement that something happened and it won't happen again.
Yeah.
You know, it's if it happens a second and a third time,
that's when
that
you stop.
Then you say, I have something in my score and I'm not sure if you have it in the part.
Yeah.
You know, so then it's not about the musician having played a wrong, quote, wrong note. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more about, oh, there's a discrepancy here. Let's resolve it.
Yeah. Because it keeps coming up. So this fall, this summer you're moving to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
This fall you will be beginning as director of the orchestras or the orchestra with the San Francisco Conservatory. And you teaching student conductors
teaching
as well?
Conducting as well, yeah.
Teaching conducting as well, which is, you know, a really great job.
I can't wait,
like
actually.
You know, it's one of the leading conservatories in the country.
Yeah, I can't wait. It's going to be a great studio.
Have you met with some of the students, or have you spoken to some of the students
already?
Yeah,
well, I mean, it's a very small program.
We
only accept two people in the conducting program at any given time.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
So that's real personal attention.
It's very individualized, And I think that's, I actually believe that's how it should be. I know that different programs work in different ways.
Well, in that case, it's less of a degree and more of an apprenticeship than anything else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what are, you know, maybe what are some of your expectations about like, this is, you spent most of your life, you know, you've traveled around the world and around the country, but most of your life has been on the East Coast, out to the Midwest a little bit. Mm-hmm. But this is a completely different part of
the
country,
obviously
a great part of the country. I guess, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I've only been out to California a few times, but
amazing part of the country.
So, I mean, obviously you're excited and, you know, there's a lot to be there, but like, what are some of your expectations and, you know, your hopes for what you plan to do?
I mean, a lot of it I'm just going to have to to kind of feel out as I go.
Of course.
I know that the orchestra is of a very high level because I've already been there and, you know, heard them. but, you know, it's an interesting thing because I think in any institution like that, you have to get to know the culture of the institution a little bit before you try to make any overt shifts,
yeah,
you know, or drastic shifts, you know. So like basically right now what I've been trying to do over the last several months and I'm continuing to do is just gather as much information as I can, just know, okay, how has this been done in the past and what's our methodology for this and what, you know, what are the students used to when it comes to this, you know, just kind of figuring out, like, you know, what are the nuts and bolts of the everyday workings of this institution, you know. And within that, I just want to kind of know all of those things up front and then base my expectations for what we can do on those things, you know, and basically say, like, all right, here's the framework. Therefore, my expectation is I'd like to elevate some things in these certain areas, and this is how I'm going to go about doing it. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I would like to... that I would like to put forward and am hopefully doing that a little bit in this first season is I would like for the orchestral training to be much more kind of across the board, equal levels of standard repertory and 20th century and new music. So that instead of having our players graduate with, you know, basically just having played the meat and potatoes of the core repertory and not a lot of 20th century or new music, that we're graduating players that have equal commerce in both, you know. And that's tough to do. It's hard to craft a season that has all of that on it.
And from my own experience with while I was a student and then after I was a student, like, and speaking with different people who are involved with Manus's orchestral program, mm-hmm. and with, mm-hmm. it's hard to do because they've tried to, you know, they try to do the same shift, and there was pushback from faculty. There's a lot of pushback from students, mm-hmm. you know, because sometimes it's interesting, you know, and I was like this too. You have kids coming in, whether they're undergrad or master's students, coming in having been told their whole lives that whatever path is the path that they're going to take, like, mm-hmm. whether it's solo, whether it's chamber music, whether it's orchestral playing, mm-hmm. and well, there are more string jobs in those fields than there are of trombone jobs,
mm-hmm.
but there's also way more string players.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, mm-hmm. when you look at, like, percentages and probabilities,
mm-hmm.
even for top of the line players, it's gonna be hard. It's hard, no matter who you are, to do that in the way that you thought you were going to when you were a kid, mm-hmm. and, like, initially picking this lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
and having that balance. Like, balance. It's not that one is necessarily worse or better than the other, although I have my own opinions about that. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, but, like, the balance and the versatility. It's like, yeah.
I think that any conservatory now, I mean, just based on how extremely difficult it has become to win orchestra auditions. We now know, it's accepted across the field, that winning an orchestra job is like moving mountains.
Yeah.
You know, and not just a major orchestra job.
And
like any orchestra job.
I've brought this up a bunch. Naples Philharmonic, I sent in a resume for. It's a part-time per service orchestra. Mm-hmm. A good one. Like, mm-hmm. it's one of those ones where, like, if you get it, it's like 18 grand a year and you can fly in from New York.
Yeah.
And they'll pay for your travel kind of deal. 75 bass trombonists,
yeah,
showed up. Like, that wasn't even who sent in resumes. That's how many people auditioned.
Actually auditioned, yeah.
Like,
exactly.
It's insane.
Yeah, like, and it's this way for every orchestra job.
For 18 grand a year job. Any position,
even for less than that.
Yeah.
You know?
It's crazy.
And that's just how it is right now. And so I think with that being the case, any conservatory that allows their student body to kind of like function under the false premise that they can just do this one thing and, you know, try to be good at it and then be, you know, even remotely guaranteed of getting work in it after they graduate, is doing them a disservice. I think that the goal of any conservatory now should be trying to, you know, it's both and, okay?
Yeah.
You have to develop every student's, you know, capabilities on their instrument or instruments to the fullest, because that's what a conservatory is. It's about, you know, honing skills.
And it's just that encompasses more things than it may have in the past.
It now encompasses more because you have to do that, and you also have to learn how to be the most versatile and broadly skilled musician as you possibly can, and think with a entrepreneurial and, you know, financial brain in addition to a, you know, purely musical one, you know, and every conservatory has an obligation now to be training these, you know, versatile, analytical, you know, proactive, you know, break out of the box kind of musicians, because that's the only way that this career is going to continue to yield results, and that the field is going to continue to refresh itself, you know. And yes, orchestras will be fine, you know, like there will always be plenty of people showing up for orchestra auditions. There's always going to be plenty of talent, you know, getting those jobs, to fill those jobs, you know. So I'm not worried about that, you know. I'm more worried about, you know, about making this orchestra program in San Francisco, you know, and just the conservatory at large. And I know that the current administration shares my thinking on this, that, you know, I'm more worried about the conservatory being a place where we can grow musicians of all stripes, mm-hmm. you know, to go on, yes, to great orchestra jobs, but also to go on to create their own chamber ensembles and to do something that brings classical music into a different sphere entirely, you know, and to become an artist that, you know, that actually is the full representation of their musical experience,
right.
you know, rather than just, you know, this is the thing I chose to do with my musicianship, even though I can do all these other things, you know. No. Actually, you're going to have the most success nowadays by being your full musical self,
yeah.
you know, and someone will want some piece of that at some point or other
yeah.
and pay for it, you know.
I've been saying this a lot recently, but I'm just at this point, like, because I play orchestra music. It's not my favorite, but I like doing it. You know, mm-hmm. I like doing it as part of a larger body of work. I like it to be one thing that mm-hmm. I do, not the thing that I do. But I'm just, but more and more, I'm just boggled that anyone ever pays me to play trombone just for anything. I'm just like, this is so great. Like, someone, I went and played my trombone. Like, last night, I went to Arlene's Grocery. I played one song with a rock band, and they gave me money afterwards. They actually gave me, it wasn't a free gig. They gave me money afterwards. I was like, this is awesome.
Beer, it's a great feeling, right? Yeah, it's like, it really actually is. Get paid to do what you love. I mean, there are yeah. a few people in this world that have that experience yeah. in general,
yeah.
you know? So that should be the whole goal. And to get to that point, I think you just have to be really inventive and just, you know, be open to a lot of things. Whenever Teeth tours around now, and we always end up doing a lot of Q&As at conservatories and universities in general, and always, you know, there's that question. There's that question of like, well, how, you know, once I get out of here, like, what do I do? You know, how do I get work, and how do I, you know, and almost across the board, the way that most of us end up answering the question and kind of agreeing upon is, you know, yes, being super talented, but also being really open,
yeah.
just open to possibilities and open to like doing things that you never thought you would necessarily do, but oh, that is a gig. That's something that sounds like I could fit in and do it, you know, so why not?
When you get that email from Trinity Wall Street asking you if you want to audition for a tenor spot in their
yeah.
chorus, maybe do it.
Maybe
because,
do it.
Because maybe that'll lead to something.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll lead to playing in your own Grammy Award winning ensemble.
Exactly.
Like a year later.
Exactly.
Or however much, you
exactly.
know, whenever
later. None of that would have happened if all of us hadn't just been open to the possibility.
Yeah.
You know, and when Roomful of Teeth started, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a guarantee of anything.
No, it.
I can remember very clearly that the initial contract was, come here for 2 weeks, we'll pay you this, you will do this, you will study with these, you know, technicians from around the world, you know, and
we'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens.
yeah.
yeah, there was no promise of any further gigs. Maybe there was like, I think there was maybe like one or two other things scheduled much later in the season that it was like, oh yeah, we have this engagement and that engagement. you know. But it was just like, let's see where it goes, you know. And since that point, it has become something that people are interested in enough to pay us to do it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, okay.
Just gotta take that step.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, Eric, I think that's would be a, that's a great place to end it.
Awesome.
So thanks, thank Dan. You so much. This was really enjoyable.
Yeah, awesome to talk with you today.